The new book, Accidental Presidents, Eight Men Who Changed America by Jared Cohen, is the first book to chronicle the presidencies of the eight men who took office after the president's death. John Tyler, Millard Fillmore, Andrew Johnson, Chester Arthur, Theodore Roosevelt, Calvin Coolidge, Harry Truman, and Lyndon Johnson. The book is the story of how these men, who were neither the voters nor their party's choice, rose to power and confronted the challenges and contours of their times. While not all of the accidental presidents were successful or adept leaders, the lessons we can learn from them does offer a roadmap for future moments of chaos and transition. Again, the name of the book is Accidental Presidents, Eight Men Who Changed America, and we welcome Jared Cohen to the roundtable this morning. Jared, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of what brought you to these eight men and what you found interesting in their shared stories.
Well, since I was a kid and my parents bought me my first book about the presidents, I've always been fascinated and confused by this idea of eight times in history, somebody who was not the voter's choice and not the voter's preference ended up presiding over the country at seminal moments in its history. So I finally decided to buckle down, spend 5 years looking at these eight abrupt transitions where the lack of a heartbeat changed the course of our history.
So in looking at that, we have John Tyler, Millard Fillmore, Andrew Johnson, Chester Arthur, Theodore Roosevelt, Calvin Coolidge, Harry Truman, and Lyndon Johnson. First of all, a lot of New Yorkers. Second of all, that group, when you start to look at them, what ultimately did you find fascinating about working with this particular cast of characters?
So there were two things that I found fascinating. One, the fact that we completely winged presidential succession, even though eight times a president died in office and 19 times you had a close call, is astonishing to me, particularly given my observation that in all eight instances, the vice president was completely disconnected from the president's inner circle, completely aloof from policy, and then thrust into the pinnacle of power. So these are men, you know, if you look at Abraham Lincoln is assassinated. We're supposed to get his vision for Reconstruction. Instead of Lincoln, you get Andrew Johnson, who was the last president to own slaves, who gave amnesty to everybody, delegated civil rights to the states, paved the way for the Jim Crow laws, and completely altered our course for 100-plus years. And this is that's the most catastrophic of the stories, but in almost each of the instances where you had these abrupt transfers of power, the course of our country was dramatically changed.
You talk in here about the ones who handled it well and perhaps the ones who didn't. And as you say, this idea of winging it. So Theodore Roosevelt and Harry Truman certainly were up to the task. Andrew Johnson, not so much. What is it, do you think, we learn from those experiences of both the good and the bad?
Well, I think that if we learn from the experience that, you know, it's typically a bad idea to have the successor not have any idea what's going on. So, you know, in some cases, as you mentioned with Andrew Johnson, it's catastrophic. In other cases, we got incredibly lucky. So Harry Truman, to me, stands out as the most successful of all the accidental presidents because in his 82 days as vice president, he only met FDR twice. He didn't get a single intelligence briefing. He wasn't familiar with the happenings at Yalta or the war and wasn't briefed on the Manhattan Project. And then on April 12, 1945, he finds himself as unexpectedly the president of the United States, presiding over a war, dealing with Stalin, reneging on all of his promises from Yalta, figuring out the post-war order, and yet he's remarkably successful despite being a provincial all-shucks politician from Missouri and makes some of the most decisive decisions of any president in history in just his first 4 months.
You point out in the book, and it's a really interesting discussion, about the selection of a vice president. Especially in today's politics, these candidates are chosen to help a candidate perhaps fill in a gap or win a seat or try to round out something that is missing from the candidate themselves. What is inherently flawed about that process when it comes to these accidental presidents?
Well, as I found in the accidental presidents, the history tells us that vice presidents have mostly been chosen either as punishment, in the case of Teddy Roosevelt being exiled to the political equivalent of Elba by New York party bosses, or because they were the available person, which is the case for most of them. But in modern times, it's very much a modern phenomenon that the candidate themselves picks a running mate. That's not how it was done throughout history. The conventions and the party bosses ended up balancing the ticket or choosing a vice president to fill it out. I think it's a dangerous thing to have the presidential nominee choosing the vice president because it biases towards electoral gimmicks to get a bump in the polls or to sort of bolster their standing when they're on the ropes and need some kind of boost. We should be looking at a vice presidential nominee and caring about one thing, which is this somebody who we can imagine leading the country? Remember, when Lyndon Johnson gave up the most powerful seat in the Senate to become vice president, he's the only one of the accidental presidents who'd really thought through the math. And he decided that there was a 20% chance statistically that if he took the position, he would end up as president of the United States. And that was a gamble that he made, and he ended up as president.
You write a lot about the 25th Amendment in the book, and which brings up one of the things that I find fascinating. Gerald Ford is not, in your definition, an accidental president.
No, Gerald Ford, I mean, the difference with the Nixon to Ford transition is, you know, it wasn't abrupt or unexpected. You know, Ford ends up being plucked from the 5th District of Michigan because Spiro T. Agnew has to resign due to a tax scandal. But the Watergate investigation and rumblings around impeachment are drawn out long enough that when Ford finally becomes president upon Nixon's resignation, it's not abrupt, it's not a surprise, it's not unexpected. But when a president dies in office, it's incredibly dramatic. And the key difference between the Nixon context and death in office is, you know, even in instances where the president is sick, so everybody knew FDR was a dying man in 1944, and nobody dared talk about it, nobody dared mention it. And even Truman himself couldn't be seen as preparing for the presidency, lest he be seen as, you know, jumping the constitutional queue. So by design, when a president historically has been sick in advance of when they've died in office, it's been this kind of taboo subject. So even Andrew Johnson, even at the moment where Lincoln is assassinated and is on his deathbed, Andrew Johnson goes to visit him at the Peterson home, and everybody knows Johnson is going to be president of the United States as soon as Lincoln takes his last breath. And yet the cabinet still says to him, you need to leave because you're making Mary Todd Lincoln uncomfortable.
Mm. Back to the 25th Amendment for a moment. This is passed in February of 1967. It makes formal the path of succession in the event of death or resignation or removal of the chief executive. You point out that no president has died in office since ratification. So how do we look at the purpose at the moment of the 25th Amendment?
Well, the first time the 25th Amendment was used was to replace the vice president. You know, as I was writing The Accidental Presidents, one of the things that I was frustrated by is why didn't these men who ascended to the presidency fill the vice presidential vacancy, particularly given how exposed that left us to constitutional crisis. And then as I was reading through the 25th Amendment, I realized they had no legal authority to do so until the 25th Amendment. And six of the eight accidental presidents, so six of the eight vice presidents who unexpectedly became president, themselves had near-death experiences in office, either to death, accident, or assassination attempt. The first time the 25th Amendment should have been used for a presidential disability was when Reagan was shot in 1981, and they didn't do it, which is why you end up with the Al Haig moment, where he famously or infamously declared himself in charge. So the only time you've had the 25th Amendment put into practice or implemented for presidential disability is during presidential colonoscopies. A colonoscopy for Reagan, one for George H.W. Bush, two for George W. Bush. So at some point, you know, we may find ourselves in a situation where we have to really set a precedent for how the 25th Amendment is used for something other than a colonoscopy.
We are, as you point out, currently in the longest period in history of not losing a president in office, and You argue that the fact that only eight presidents having died in office is really a miracle. That's the odds are are pretty incredible.
Well, especially when you consider the 19 close calls. I mean, you had Andrew Jackson was shot at point blank and the gun malfunctioned, so he beat the assailant with his cane. Andrew Johnson, after ascending to the presidency, was on his deathbed a month into his presidency, so much so that they alerted the president pro tempore, who was out west, that he needed to rush back to Washington. John Tyler, who's the nation's first accidental president, there's an explosion on board the USS Princeton on February 28, 1844. It kills more senior officials than any other moment in American history. It kills two members of the cabinet, the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Navy, and it nearly kills John Tyler, but he's downstairs below deck flirting with a woman who ends up later becoming the first lady. And then my two favorite examples are FDR as president-elect is giving a speech in Miami, and an Italian immigrant named Giuseppe Zangara fires 5 shots at him in 15 seconds and doesn't kill FDR because a 100-pound woman named Lillian Cross smacks him with his purse and thwarts his aim. And that's before you even get into JFK nearly being killed by a suicide bomber as president-elect, who had the dynamite in his pants with his finger on the trigger 4 feet from him at church and didn't pull the trigger because there were too many children around.
And I scraped my memory pretty good, Jared, but I could not remember fully or maybe even at all the 2005 attack on President George W. Bush in Georgia.
Yeah, so the attack on George W. Bush in Georgia is a great example of close calls that don't end up injuring anybody get very quickly buried under the rug and lost in the annals of history. So when he's in Tbilisi, an assailant throws a live grenade at the president. It ricochets off a woman's head, slowing down its trajectory. It lands about 61 feet, and it was a live grenade, and it would have exploded, but the assassin had wrapped a tartar cloth around it, which made it so the pin didn't function properly. And then the plates in the grenade, in addition to that, which are responsible for the chemical reaction, also didn't function. Had that grenade gone off, there's a very decent chance that shrapnel could have hit the president, and it almost certainly would have killed a number of people around where it landed.
And again, you would think that that's something that we would, because the assassination attempts of, now obviously Reagan was injured, Gerald Ford was not, and yet still many people know of those instances.
I mean, Gerald Ford had two women pull a gun on him in the span of 35 days. Lynette Squeaky Fromm shot him at almost point blank, but the gun malfunctioned. And then Sarah Jane Moore took a shot at him from about 40 feet away, but a heroic Secret Service agent was able to get his finger between the assassin and the trigger. You also had Harry Truman, who, while he was in the Blair House was assaulted by two Puerto Rican rebels and killed a Secret Service agent. Teddy Roosevelt, just a year after ascending to the presidency, was riding in a carriage in Pittsfield, and a trolley slammed into it, ended up killing the first Secret Service agent ever killed in the line of duty, killing the driver. Teddy Roosevelt gets flown 40 feet, lands face down, breaks his glasses, has to get surgery, and is in a wheelchair for 6 weeks.
In looking at these accidental presidents, as you say, a lot of this just seems to be on the fly. Do you think books like this and just sort of understanding this history helps us better understand what could happen, what should happen in the case of the unthinkable?
So I think that while we're in this period of the longest moment in history without a president dying in office, it's easy to forget how frequently this has happened in our history. And I think it's interesting as we go into 2020, you know, the accidental presidents is a good read for people, you know, who are thinking about whether it's, we have the oldest president in history. We have two serious contenders on the Democratic side who are in their late 70s. I think this is an election where the vice president is gonna matter a lot. And it's an election where I think we need to take the vice president very seriously. I also think the accidental presidents is a good gut check on our recency bias about the current moment. You know, this book is anchored around these 8 deaths in office, but it's also a refresher in a vast history that I cover where the country has been so polarized at moments where you had a senator pull a gun on another senator and try to shoot him right there in the chamber, where, you know, impulsiveness and erratic behavior by the president results in the annexation of Texas more than just, you know, sending messages on social media. And by the way, the book also tells you about the first time that an average American trolled the president and got a response. A woman named Julia Sand, who lived on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, sent Chester Arthur more than 30 letters telling him what a terrible man he was. And the letters had such an impact on him that the president literally gets in his carriage and shows up at her townhouse because he wants to meet the woman who's been snail mail trolling him.
The book is fascinating. It is titled Accidental Presidents, 8 Men Who Changed America. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Jared Cohen is the author. Jared, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Accidental Presidents. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.